Hello and welcome to the Disney Magic Hour, episode number 59. On this week's show, we delve back into the Disney Movie Hour, this week featuring 101 Dalmatians. To my left, as always, is Melissa. Say hello, Melissa.
Hello, Melissa.
Joining me via Skype is Brian. Say hello, Brian.
Hello, Brian.
And also joining us via Skype from the Main Street Gazette is Ryan. Say hello, Ryan.
Hello, Ryan.
Hello, Pete. And say hello, Pogo. This episode of Disney Magic Hour is brought to you by MEI Travel. For all your vacation planning needs, to visiting Walt Disney World, taking a cruise, or traveling anywhere around the globe, go over, visit the experts at meitravel.com, where Becky and her team can get you started on your own adventure as we get into our adventure this week. And the music that you heard earlier was Wishery. You can find that video and more over at youtube.com/pogo. And all of his music over at soundcloud.com/pogomix. We are lastgenpodcast.com. Find us on Twitter at Diz Magic Hour Pond. At Diz Magic Hour Pod. That is D-I-S Magic Hour Pod. Over at Facebook, if you search for the Disney Magic Hour, you can find our group and add yourself to it. Head on over to iTunes and Melissa will read your 5-star review. And we have a bunch to read at the end of the night tonight. Thank you very much. Wow.
We don't do music.
All of our previous episodes can be found over at soundcloud.com/Disney Magic Hour Podcast. And you can find us also at Google Play Music. Melissa, where can they find pretty pictures?
On Instagram at Disney Magic Hour Podcast.
And right from the top, I want to say, Ryan, where can everyone find you and the Main Street Gazette going strong?
The Main Street Gazette is at mainstgazette.com. On Twitter and Instagram, it's Main ST Gazette. And on Facebook, if you search for Main Street Gazette, you'll find us there.
Huzzah!
I loved your article about food and wine. I was a little nervous because you said that there was some bad stuff, but then once I read it, I kind of understood where you're coming from. So thank you for forewarning.
I thought I would do it that way instead of drag it out to the end for people. And I was like, oh no, give it to them now. Let them realize that there are some not great things to do and move on to the better things.
Yeah, but you got the magical one right.
Yeah.
It's magic.
Which one was the magical one?
We had it in the Islands of the Caribbean. The pork.
Oh, yeah, that was really good.
Yeah, Mojo pork.
Yeah, that was insanely good. That's a nice little section they have back there.
Yeah.
We wanted to do a little more on food and wine this week, but unfortunately, there were two nights that we went. The first night that we went, a friend of ours misplaced their phone. And that basically took up like an hour and a half of our night to not, you know, it's just a whatever. We found it. That's all that mattered. And then the second night we went, it was the rains.
We attempted to go.
Yeah, we didn't even get there. We actually went to the parking lot and it was the rains down in Africa. And we didn't even attempt it. We wound up just going to a local Mexican restaurant called El Patron where Del Rio does not work. And the food there was really good. But, yeah, we haven't really gotten a chance to delve into food and wine as much as we wanted to our first week because we had so much going on. And the weather a couple of days in a row was not your typical, hey, it's going to rain for 5 minutes, Florida. It was strap in. It's going to be 3 hours worth of rain.
Yeah. But I do believe me and Steph will be giving you some food and wine in the next couple coming weeks.
Yep. Yep. You're going to have a nice little episode about that. If I seem a little under the weather with my voice or I'm coughing, it's because I am and I am. I had a cold when I got back from San Francisco. It felt better. And then I went to Universal Horror Nights, Halloween Horror Nights over at Universal. It was my first visit and it rained for about the last 2.5 hours I was there. And I was not interested in letting that have me miss stuff. So me and Jimmy Styles and Mike, we braved it as much as we could going through the rain from house to house near the end of the night. And I don't regret it because I had a really good time. But wow, do I feel terrible as a result. Me and Jimmy, though, we're going to do an episode about Halloween Horror Nights soon because we're going to be going again next week for a tour a Lights On tour. And then Melissa's going to be going for her first time October 30th.
Yeah.
It's going to be fun.
Right before Halloween.
Yeah, night before Halloween, which actually, strangely, one of the slower nights. I know you wouldn't. Yeah, you wouldn't think that. But actually, the day before Halloween and Halloween itself are two of the slower nights for Halloween Horror Nights. And it reflects in the amount that they charge for the Express Pass, because that's always an extra charge to get like front of the line access, which, hey, guess what? You need. Those nights are not as expensive as most of the other nights throughout October. They're markedly cheaper, almost like $30-$40 cheaper.
Oh, wow. That's great.
Yeah, it's strange, but good for us because it's a Sunday night. They're going to be open until, I believe, 2 in the morning or something.
Oh, dear.
So, yeah, we're going to be out there a long time. I had a really good time. I have some opinions that we'll get into when we do that show. Basically, a few complaints and then a fair amount of praise. So, but we'll get into that later down the line. This week, we are back into the Disney Movie Hour, which I feel like we haven't visited for quite some time. Was Swiss Family Robinson the last one that we did?
Yeah.
Either that or Sleeping Beauty. It was one of the two.
I think it was Swiss, because that was 1960, yeah. And I think Beauty was 59, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's been a little while since we have delved into the movie, just due to everyone's schedules and stuff. So this week, what are we talking about? We're talking about 101 Dalmatians. This film, some notes, of course, notes, was released in 1961 on January 25th. It's got a running time of 79 minutes and a budget of $4 million. In the end, to date, this film has raked in over $215 million, 144 of that coming in domestic sales and 71 of it coming from foreign sales. It received 4 re-releases in 1969, 79, 85, and 91.
And in 1991, it was the 10th highest grossing film of that year.
Yes, and it did even better on the year that it was released.
Yes, it did.
So it was based on the 1956 children's novel by Dodie Smith.
I thought it was Dottie.
Is it Dottie? It probably is. Is it Lodi? Does anyone have a clarification on proper saying of name?
Nope.
I'm going to go with Dottie. I like that better.
It's tomato, tomato, Dottie, Dodie, whatever.
Dodie, Dottie. This was an interesting production for this film because it implemented the use of xerography into the animation progress. Basically Xerox technology. It allowed for the animators for their drawings to be put directly onto the cell, eliminating the need for hand inking, which greatly reduced the production costs. So you don't have to hand ink each and every animated cell. Instead, you have, you know, and instead of hand drawing the 99 puppies, you could, in a sense, photocopy them.
Yeah, but...
But...
That led to some issues.
That leads to some issues, but I think it gives the movie character in the end.
It does.
That's an argument to be had, but it. What were you going to say?
Who developed it?
Xerox.
No.
Okay, keep going.
It's our friend.
Ub Iwerks?
Ub.
Well, he didn't develop it, but he
played around with the point that, yeah, it was able to be used in this context.
Yeah, because it wasn't really made for filmmaking processes. It was made for other stuff.
He kind of Frankensteined it into something they could use.
Exactly. But the thing that was interesting about that is that it can lead to a lot of rough-looking animation.
Yeah, there were times where you definitely saw the the lines that they use. Like, you know, when you draw the head and they draw those lines in there, you could see that in some of the frames.
And, of course, Xeroxing at that time, it was only workable with black.
Yeah.
So everything is heavily outlined with black lines, which in multiple scenes in Sleeping Beauty and Fantasia in particular, there are no outlines to people's clothing. It's just that, you know, the clothing and then it's the background color. There's no actual black line outside of that. So it gave it a little more of a sketchy kind of look, which made it stick out very, very much from obviously all the previous Disney films. But it also saved them a ton of money in a time where they needed to, because they had lost so much money on Sleeping Beauty because of the production time and the production cost, and even Lady and the Tramp, because they had to make two versions.
Yeah.
You know, because they were doing the formatting thing at that point. So this was almost, I don't want to call it a necessary evil, because I also feel, I mean, Ryan, let me know if you agree with this. After the rigidity that was put in place for the animation process on Sleeping Beauty, the animators coming to this we're probably so much more relaxed and maybe enjoying the process a bit more.
They were, and it was for them, truly, it was the first time they could see their work directly on the screen. It was their hands, their drawings being translated to the screen. And there's a story that they had a memo going around animation department saying, you know, make sure you're not putting your production, you know, your lines for scale and your lines to make sure you're doing your pieces correctly in the background, because it will copy over. And most of them had their assistants going through and erasing out the background lines. And you have someone like, you know, Milt Call, who was absolutely adamant, no one touches his lines. Like, this was going to be his. It was translated to the screen. And if something got through, something got through. But these were his drawings now.
Mm-hmm. Now, Brian, did you find this style of animation distracting at all during the movie? Or was it just fine with you? You know, did you see it and go like, okay, that's a little bit new? And then it didn't bother you, or did it stick out a little more?
No, it didn't stick out to me. I mean, I noticed that it had a different animation style. And the thing to me is, it's kind of a look that they carry over, I think, into the future a little bit. So it didn't really, I don't think it really stuck out to me until I read about the techniques that they used to do the animation.
Yeah, because then you're going to see this used a lot more going through the 60s and the 70s especially.
Yeah, it didn't really get to perfection to the point where it's unnoticeable until The Rescuers.
Yeah. And this film was also kind of a rarity because it was a very recent work.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Disney purchased the rights to the book in 1957 and then quickly did a turnaround on getting this out there. And the story only had one story writer adapting it, and that was Bill Peet.
Yeah.
That also was not a thing that usually happened. Usually it would go through multiple drafts.
Yeah.
But this one, to my knowledge, to what I read, pretty much ran off the first draft. To where the original author even said that it was improved from the novelization version, which, you know, we'll obviously in 64, I believe, we'll get to a situation where the person who was doing that was not yeehaw happy about, the work that was done on their stuff. So I found that really kind of fascinating that it was, I would say, one of the smoothest productions that they seemingly to this point have had.
Yeah, but it did lead to some tension because Walt wasn't necessarily so happy with the technique. You know, he said it wasn't the fantasy type look that he had previously gone for.
Yeah, no, absolutely true. And you can see why. It's agreeable. Like, yeah. You know, it is absolutely nothing like that. And he wasn't so grand about this idea, but
I think it fits, though, because this is one of the things that it's not a fairy tale. You know, it's a recent story.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think it kind of works for this.
And ultimately, in the end, I'm sorry, Brian, go ahead.
Oh, no. Another thing that I, when reading up on this, that I had seen was that the author, Dodie Smith, actually kind of was hoping that Disney would turn this into a film. You know, that's what I came across. I don't know if that was true and stuff, but that that's something that I had read, that she wrote it, or he, I'm guessing it's a she, right? Dodie
Smith? I don't know.
Yeah.
Could be.
It's a woman, guys. It's a woman. No more.
It's apparently short for Dorothy.
Yeah, it's short for Dorothy. Dorothy Gale.
BTW.
She got taught in a twister.
No.
That was the last time she was ever seen. Oh my God, we have, actually, when we get to the casting, we have yet another voice actor or actor who never did anything past this film. Which has become a running joke for me.
Yeah, yes. I had some cool trivia.
Okay, well, let's get into that in a moment. I got some other stuff I just want to go into. Okay, just a couple more things. Just give me a second.
No.
So in the end, though, despite Walt's what would you say? You know,
hesitation.
Thank you very much. Hesitations towards the process being used. It wound up being the top grossing film of 1961, beating out films such as West Side Story and Breakfast at Tiffany's. It actually became the second highest grossing film of the decade, topped only by The Sound of Music. This also gave Disney two straight years of having the highest grossing film, in that in 1960, it was Swiss Family Robinson. And before the decade is over, two more Disney films would win the highest grossing film in their respected year. So four out of the 10 years in the 60s, it was a Disney-produced film that was the highest grossing film of that year. And it was split. Well, It was sort of split. It was a live action, a mix, and then two live action films.
Wait,
so
you said
two animated films.
Two animated, okay.
Oh, sorry, two animated films. Thank you very much.
Is it too many live actions?
Yes, too many live actions. Too much. Too much torturing of animals.
No.
And ah, so Stanley Robinson.
Unlike this movie, no animals.
No animals were tortured, at least I think.
I don't know.
Who is this film directed by, Melissa? Do you want to talk about that a little bit? I have it on my sheet if you don't have it in front of ye.
I always have it.
All right, great.
I can never pronounce half their names, though.
Great. So,
because these are three repeats. We've had them before.
Yes, we have.
We had Wolfgang Reitherman. Reitherman?
Reitherman. Yeah.
This was his second directorial debut. He had...
Well, okay. You can't really have two debuts, but I'm going to go with it.
He did. It was his debut in the 60s. His first was Sleeping Beauty.
Okay.
And he'll go on to direct many, many more after this.
Well, in particular, can we point out a couple of them? Actually, he would
Sword
later...
Sword in the Stone, Jungle Book, Aristocats, Robin Hood, The Many Adventures of Winnie the Pooh, and The Rescuers.
And he was also directing animator on Lady and the Tramp and Alice in Wonderland and Cinderella.
Yeah.
Who else was on the directing staff?
Hamilton, Lusk.
All right.
Every time. He also was director on Fantasia, Pinocchio, Reluctant Dragons, Saludos Amigos, So Dear to My Heart. Cinderella, Alice in Wonderland, Peter Pan, Lady and the Tramp, and Mary Poppins.
And for you Disneyland nerds, he was also the director of the TV specials Disneyland 59 and Disneyland USA, which right now I think the only way you can actually see those is on the Disneyland USA Treasures DVD collection, which if you didn't buy it back then, it's a rough go now because they go about for $85 to $90 on Amazon. I don't know if they ever have plans on releasing those in Blu-ray. I wish they would.
Was that one of the TCM things? There was a TCM thing.
There was. The Disney 59 special was on there.
Yeah, that was just
it absolutely
a couple
was.
Weeks ago.
I actually think that the Disneyland story was on there as well. Disneyland USA. I believe that was on there as well. Who was our third director? This is the name we've heard a million times.
Yeah, Clyde...
Geronimi? Say it. Okay, good.
Yeah,
that's what has he worked on before?
Cinderella, Alice in Wonderland, Peter Pan, Lady and the Tramp, Sleeping Beauty, and many others that I didn't write down.
The only one that really matters is The Adventures of Ichabod and Mr. Toad.
Mm.
Say it with me. Ichabod.
Sleeping Beauty.
He also worked on Peter and the Wolf, Melody Time. And yeah, as you said, Sleeping Beauty, Lady and the Tramp, Alice in Wonderland, Cinderella, just incredible. And a ton of Marvel cartoons in the 60s when he went and did that. And I'm sure those are all nuts. You want to talk about music? Let's talk about music. Let's talk about music. George Bruns, who composed over 60 films in his time, including Jungle Book, The Love Bug, Sword in the Stone, Aristocats, and Robin Hood. Now, you kind of see a pattern in the style of music in those. They're a little more jazzy, a little more, I would say, 60s-esque. Would I be out of line in saying that, Mr. Wilson?
No, I think you're right on it. In fact, that you know, there actually were in this movie, there's four songs, but the Cruella song he originally wrote, when they went back, he went back and redid it because there was a blues line that he felt like would be better to put to that song. So they changed the lyrics around. They changed the song around to make it that more jazzy feel.
And now the Cruella song was actually written by Mel Levin?
Yes.
And it was performed by Bill Lee, who was the singing voice of Roger in this film. Since it's been re-recorded a couple of times, in particular, Dr. John did the remake for the live action, the redo for the live action remake, which obviously we'll get to eventually. And for some god-awful reason, Hayden Panettiere and Selena Gomez did two versions of it. And I said this in the group today. I listened to the Gomez version today, so you don't have to. You're welcome. It's terrible.
I didn't make it through it.
It's so bad.
It's like that terrible version of Poor Unfortunate Souls that they play at the Halloween party.
Oh, that is awful.
It really is.
Yeah. And someone on the page also brought up how awful the Demi Lovato version of Let It Go is.
Oh, yeah.
And like
anything Demi Lovato was awful, so it doesn't surprise me.
She's a strong woman, though.
Yes, she is. Do you know who... Bill Lee is.
Who is Bill Lee? Tell me all about it.
He's part of the Mellow Men.
Yeah.
So he's done many a voices every time we talked about the Mellow Men singing groups, like in the Pirates for Peter Pan, in Alice in Wonderland. He was part of that group.
Huzzah.
Now he got a solo.
Yeah, he did. He was, killed everyone else off. And he's like, mine now. My time. And he cast them into the fire. Speaking of casting... Who's in this cast? Hey-oh!
A ton of people.
There's a lot of cast in this movie. We're not going to be able to go through everybody because
each of the Dalmatians had an actor.
we're going to name a fair amount, but I'm going to try to do them in as quick an order as possible because we will be here till next Tuesday.
Yeah.
First and foremost, the voice of Pongo, the voice of Pongo is Rod Taylor, well known for his role in The Birds and one of my favorite all-time movies, 1960s, The Time Machine. He had a huge career in TV and film. His final performance, though.
Mine.
What?
I know it.
Okay, what was his final performance?
Winston Churchill
in
Inglourious Basterds.
Directed by?
Oh my!
Come on, that's the easiest part.
It's Tarantino.
It is. Okay. Yeah, you're right. No, okay. That's good. Okay, I was like, wow, you should not have known the front part of that without stumbling onto the back part of that.
I didn't want to look like a fool.
Okay. Yeah. Ah, who voiced Perdita?
Kate Bauer.
Kate Bauer. And Kate Bauer is our mystery woman of the week.
Wait, do you know though what she did?
I thought
you
really liked it. Yes, I did. I wrote it down. Yes, I did. She only has two credits to her name. The first being in, honestly, another one of my top five films of all time, Carol Reed's The Third Man as Miss Hedwig.
Wait, was she in the film or the TV series?
I think she was in the film itself.
Oh, because I thought it was the TV series, because when I clicked on the link, it brought me to TV series.
Yeah, see, I had some weird connections with that, too. Maybe
you're
right.
Because they did do a TV series, and the time that they credited for, 1959, was the time of the TV series.
Okay, all right.
Yeah,
you might be right.
From what I'm reading, it was the series, yeah.
Okay.
The TV series.
So, but then that's it. She voices a dog, and then she goes off into the ether. Like, what do they do? And if you guys have noticed, most of the time it's the woman.
Do you think they make a sacrifice to make the movie? I think the movie be a hit. Maybe?
I don't know if they're making phenomenal money off of royalties and stuff. I don't think so.
Yeah, but she wouldn't start making royalties immediately. That she'd be like, I'm done with this business.
I don't know. I don't know what it is.
Yeah,
so weird. J. Pat O'Malley voices Colonel and Jasper. He's got over two... Jasper. He has over 200 credits to his name. But you may remember him when he played another colonel, an elephant, in The Jungle Book. And in Alice in Wonderland, he was almost everybody, being the walrus, the carpenter, and Dee and Dumb.
And Cyril.
And Cyril Proudfoot, right? Proudfoot?
No.
You don't think so?
No.
What is the last name in the horse of Mr. Toad?
Is it Featherbottom?
I'm going to look it up.
It's something with a bottom.
Proud Bottom. It might just be Proud Bottom.
I think that's right.
All right, Cyril. Let's look him up right now because this is important.
Proud Bottom.
Proud Bottom. Yeah, not Proudfoot.
Yep.
Proudfoot, what is that? Oh, that's the Lord of the Rings.
Oh,
that's what I was thinking of.
Yes.
That was Lord of the Rings. Proudfeet. Okay, who do we got next?
Well, Melissa? You skipped over...
I didn't... There is no order. There's 1,000 names.
Well, in order of importance.
I don't know what... Okay, very well. Who's next?
Well, I put Cruella down.
Okay, who did it?
Betty Lou Gearson.
Gearson? I like how you took a little moment.
Because I didn't know... I never know if it's like a hard G or a soft G. Gearson.
Where else can people have seen her?
She was actually the narrator of Cinderella.
Mm-hmm. She also appeared in Twilight Zone, Dick Van Dyke Show. And I thought this was interesting. Her last voice role was in the WB's animated film Cats Don't Dance.
I never even heard of that.
No, neither did anyone else, I think.
No.
Except that one person who heard it and right now is like, well, I know it. Congratulations. You watched a really average animated film when you were younger.
I did think it was really interesting, the live-action model for Cruella.
Mm-hmm.
Mary Wicks. She, like, did everything. She did Broadway. She did film. She did TV. Like,
Assassin.
She was everywhere. And apparently Disney villainous.
Mm, very good. It's good to have background. Who else is the most important on your list?
Well, we got Ben Wright is the speaking voice of Roger.
Yes, he is.
He narrated Cleopatra.
Yeah, that movie is a thing.
And he was also, I guess, more infamous for, or more famous, for being Herr Zeller from The Sound of Music.
Sound of Music. And his last work actually was the voice of Grimsby in The Little Mermaid. He also did a lot of TV work on Perry Mason, The Untouchables, and Twilight Zone as well, because Twilight Zone was kind of like the Law and Order of its time. Like everyone sort of found their way on there at one point or another. Do you want to talk about Anita?
Anita
was voiced by Lisa Davis, who actually really mainly did TV work following and previous to 101 Dalmatians, Perry Mason, Beverly Hillbillies, lots of appearances on the George Burns Show. Let's talk about Martha Wentworth next.
Wait, you forgot the live action model for Anita.
Okay, who is it?
It's the same person who actually also did Sleeping Beauty and Cinderella, Helen Stanley.
Helen Stanley.
So if those three ladies look familiar.
Yeah, there's a reason. Yeah. Actually, Martha Wentworth, who voices the nanny looked kind of familiar to me as well.
Animation-wise,
Flora, right? I mean, I'm not crazy, right?
Well,
it's like the same face.
The same little, like, pop in her step.
Very similar. She actually voiced three roles in the film, though. As Nanny, Lucy the Goose. Yes, Lucy Goosey. I mean, what do you want, folks? This is what happens. And one of the cows, Queenie, in what I will call the most disturbing scene in the film. In a movie about a woman attempting to skin 99 puppies, the cow scene made me uneasy. Finally.
Wait, you forgot what her other voice work will be.
What will it be?
Madam Mim.
Great. We know she can scream at very high volumes.
No, Madam Mim's awesome.
We'll get into that when we get into
that one.
Oh, I can't wait either. I also want to bring up Tom Conway. Actually makes two appearances in the film as the Quizmaster, which that's happening on TV when Jasper Horse and Lucky are watching TV. And he was also the Collie, who basically saves everyone from freezing to death. And you may recognize him as the narrator of Peter Pan.
And we have some familiar faces back.
Okay,
do you Barbara Luddy.
Don't keep it a secret. Let them know.
Barbara Luddy. Okay. She played Rover. She was Lady from Lady and the Tramp. We have Thurl Ravenscroft again. He was the captain. And Queenie Leonard, who was one of the cows also, Princess. She was the snooty flower from Alice and the Bird in the Treehouse.
Wait, are you telling me that somebody in a scene where a cow was named Queenie, another one of the cows' real name in life was Queenie?
Yeah, but she played Princess.
Strange. Strange. Stranger. Strangest. That is this. All right, enough of this. There's 1,000 people. We can't go over it all.
Oh, no, those
Unless
are just
Nixon is in it, like somewhere, we can move on. Or Ronald Reagan. The man had a movie with a monkey.
No.
Bedtime for Bonzo. Check it out, folks. It's terrible. It's terrible. It's not even funny terrible. It's just terrible. Ryan Wilson.
What we got?
Let's get into this film.
What you want to know?
where do we start from? What sticks out to you right from the beginning with this opening sequence, the credits?
You know what? I'm gonna throw this figure out there because I found this today and I was shocked.
Stealing my trivia.
So when we start, I am feeling like trivia. So we start out, we get the title sequence. It's the Dalmatian spot, and it leads to musical notes. So apparently somebody went through and counted all the spots, all the Dalmatian spots in the entire film. And throughout the film, we're going to see 6,469,952 Dalmatian spots.
Really?
Crazy.
That's what it says.
Did you check this?
I got the same
source
number.
The source I got for this says this is what Disney told me. I'm going to hold it as true. And I'm like, well, then that's good enough for me.
Yeah, that's fine. One day we will go back and find this out.
Well, I like how they also came up with the spots, like on the dogs. They little technique that they used just to kind of sidetrack a little bit. But they picked one spot as like an anchor spot, and then they made like a constellation type of thing. So that's why each dog has its own like unique pattern. But you can always tell certain dogs, like Lucky has like the little horseshoe shaped spots on his back. Right. So yeah, that's kind
of
how
And that would be so difficult to keep track of if you didn't implement like a system like that. Yeah.
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 All right, cool. If anyone's interested, you can try to count all the spots and then call us when you're in a loony bin. Let us know how it goes. Just write an email. We're not going to come and get you. Just let you know. I'll send Chief to save you, a la One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. That's how it will end.
It's good stuff. So,
do you know how that movie ends?
I taught the book when I taught English, so
okay.
Yes.
Oh, all right. Okay.
I read the book, and then we watched the movie, because that's what you do in English class.
I first learned about it from The Simpsons.
Oh, well, that too.
And then I saw the movie.
That's so, where you learn all great things
where
in life.
You learn all the best things in life. I was like, what is The Raven? I shall look this into.
I showed that during one of the times I was substituting in an English class.
The Simpsons version?
Yep.
Good. At least you didn't show the Vincent Price version. That is terrible.
Ooh.
Oy. Oh, my goodness. All right. Movie. Dogs.
Back to dogs.
Back to dogs. Hey. This is the most 60s credit sequence that I can imagine.
I liked it. It reminded me of like the Rhapsody in Blue from Fantasia 2000.
No, I think it gives the film a very time and space, but I also think that's kind of unique because I would argue that most of the films we've seen to this point are sort of timeless. Mm-hmm. This one, I think, is like, you know when this came, like when this came about. Yeah, it's got like a vibe to itself.
Yeah.
So I don't really think that we had seen anything like that before. You know, Brian, you dug the sequence? I'll say dug.
Yeah, I did. I dug that, man.
Mm.
It was, it was cool. And I agree. Yeah, it was. It seemed to like bounce all around. Also, too, it seemed to incorporate different styles in the opening sequence. I liked it.
I also really like, and I've enjoyed other films that have done this, when they're showing a cast member's name up, the visuals that are going on match it. So when they're saying who did the sound design, there's a sound bar. And yep. When you're dealing with the layouts, there's a huge layout. Then the color comes in and it says who the color stylist was.
Yeah,
it was kind of cool. I don't know why, but this really reminded me a lot of Spielberg's Catch Me If You Can.
Oh, yeah.
You know, sort of that moving, you know, introduction piece. Which also, that's sort of a rarity nowadays because your credits are always at the end, you know, yeah. of the films, except like Tarantino films. Normally, they're always in the front. So this reminded me of Catch Me If You Can in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, this was like one of the first animated films where like the cast was actually like a chunk of the credits, like, you know. But I liked the implementation of how, you know, it wasn't just here are names and what they did, like it was like the whole moving thing. And
I also would love to take the opening dialogue of Time Machine and just overlay it into this film and see if it makes sense, because I think it would, or vice versa.
What that is.
It's just more
like
Rod,
I know what the
Taylor
movie is,
awesomeness,
but I don't know what
is
the opening thing is.
Okay, so Ryan, why don't you get us into the story? Like, where do we start from? Where are we going? How are we introduced to our boy Pongo?
So we're introduced. He is our narrator to start out. Of course, he's saying he lives in this flat in London with his pet. We think he's talking about the dog, and we're hearing from Roger. Turns out that we've flipped the script. We have – so now he's sitting there. He's looking out the window, and he's realized that, you know, while the bachelor life has been great, that, you know, Roger needs to move on and find a wife, and hopefully she has a dog that is somewhat compatible with him, that at least it won't be, you know, an awkward living situation.
Yeah, and actually I noticed something when we were just watching it. The animation of the woman in the magazine struck off a memory to me, and I'm a big fan of this. He's done a lot of DC and Marvel work. Tim Sale. And I saw a lot of influence on Tim Sale's artwork that would come much, much later in life, drawn straight from that kind of style. But I also wondered, that whole sequence when Pongo is looking out at different women as they're walking by, in the modern age, you would get a group that would whine about sexism in this sequence. So I'm happy that this film exists where it exists, because it's also, sadly, exactly what everyone does. Like, this was a really good, accurate portrayal of what a guy thinks of just from the animated stylings of a dog.
Oh, what, like high maintenance or?
Yeah. Like just, you know, just from like looking like no, yes.
Yeah.
It's like history of the world. It's all the same. But
I don't know if it's all the same. I like this.
Yeah, it was a good. No, it was a good way to do that, like through the voice of a dog, so it didn't seem as
off-putting.
I don't know what the word is. Off-putting, yes.
Yeah, it was different.
And they even preface it with the whole, you know, I don't really know what's great for a human, but I kind of have gathered a good idea. So he's kind of like hedged his bets right there.
And I like how the dogs match their owners, like, you know.
Yeah.
the long orange hair and like the little squat woman, the little pug.
All right, so Pongo, man, really? Pongo decides, okay, we got one. We got a winner. Let's get this guy and let's go find this ladies. Pretty lady and this pretty dog. So they go off and he finds them finally in the park where Roger then tosses his just blown out match into the brush like a moron. Hopefully nothing sets itself on fire and kills everything. They have a little meet cute, classic kind of meet cute. Through violence? No.
Yeah.
They have a little tumble. I thought it was fun. I thought this whole sequence was really fun. I thought, you know, Rod Taylor's really just, he's driving the story, which is interesting because then he kind of goes away later in the film. You know, for like an entire portion of the film, you don't see our, you know, quote unquote, our two main dogs who we're introduced to. They're sort of in the background.
Yeah.
But I think that it plays out nicely. It's a cute little introduction. I mean, it worked for me. Brian, did you take it as kind of old folksy, or did it work for you?
No, I liked it. I mean, it was very, very romantic movie. Dogs tangling them up in their leashes and
skinning dogs.
They're falling into the water and then they're both mad at each other and then they realize how stupid the situation is and they have a little laugh and I liked it.
And they get married.
Yeah, that's the way it usually works.
That's how it works. Get married. They have no friends evidently because there's no one at that wedding.
Yeah, there's nobody at that
kinda
wedding.
Kind of sad. Kind of sad. Yeah. There literally is no one in that wedding. Melissa, is that okay with you?
They don't need anyone.
Oh, wow. Okay. Trust me, living with only one person is maddening. They do need some. Oh, they got dogs.
They got dogs, yeah. They and the dogs got married, too.
Yeah.
They get Nanny.
What was that?
Yeah.
And they get Nanny. So they have
that's
this
right,
thing, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. They have a nanny. They keep saying how they don't have any money, but they got a nanny.
Yeah, that struck me as
all right.
Odd.
Yeah. She came with the house.
Came with the house, just like American Horror Story, which I started watching recently. It's okay so far.
It's all right.
It's not scary. I don't know what it's like.
It's not.
What
no.
are you talking about?
It's people creepy.
Are, what are they? No, it's not.
It's creepy.
It's edited creepily. It's like, huh, what are you doing over there? All right.
Why are you in that corner over there?
Back to the Dags. So we get a wedding, and we are introduced to Cruella.
Like 6 months or something go by, like we were told that, and Purdita is expecting babies.
Yes. Purdy is now expecting pups.
Which I liked that she was like, dogs have been having puppies for a long time before me. Like it was just like a casual, like, this is what's happening, but, you know.
Okay. Now, I did not remember that Roger is actually the person who writes the Cruella de Vil song. This is the first time I saw this movie in a long time. I didn't realize that the song actually lived in the movie as an actual breathing thing.
Yeah.
I thought this was kind of cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I
and
did
he's doing
too.
It, yeah. And he's doing it as a, you know, hey, this crazy woman's downstairs and I'm going to just be a complete jerk about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm gonna bang and blow my horn.
I thought it sounded great. I thought it was good. Yeah, I really liked it. I like the air that they give Cruella right off the bat. I think it shows that she will become like a very memorable villain pretty much from step one.
Yeah.
I also enjoyed that she drove like one of our heroes, Toad. I thought they'd be friends.
True.
Because Toad like wouldn't get it that like she's just murdering things. He would just laugh that part off and probably not pay attention to it.
Yeah.
And then just get back to talking about the car.
Yeah.
So kind of enjoyed that. So a great intro scene for Cruella, but I like that they introduce the danger of her right away, but not through like the humans taking up any real honest worry, but the dogs.
Yeah,
you know, the dogs are wondering like, why does she want to know? What is, you know, like, what does it matter to her when I'm going to have puppies? So it's pretty. I think it's kind of a disturbing. She's a really disturbing villain.
Yeah.
She is the most disturbing villain that we have come across so far. She really is. She's just creepy.
You would put her above Maleficent.
In terms of that, Maleficent is more of the classic, like, I don't know. It seems more like a classic fantasy type villain, where as Cruella de Vil, it seems like the kind of crazy neighbor lady that you might know, who might also have a body in her basement type of thing.
Because she's like,
and that's the kind that she is.
She's the first villain that doesn't have any mythical or mystic like element to her. Like, she doesn't do any magic. She doesn't live in a storybook. Like, she is a real person. So. Yeah.
That's true. Are you on board with that, Ryan? With her being like her own sort of a new thing, a new introduction of a different kind of villain?
Yeah, I think, it's definitely a new introduction of a kind of villain. And she definitely is one of the creepiest, probably because it is more real. Like, we could totally all have that lady next door with the body in the basement. Like, you know, and so I think I could buy into that. And she does, you know, very quickly establishes that. We have Perdita hiding at like under a really tiny shelf to try to get away from her, so everyone feels this claustrophobic piece from her. So yeah, definitely.
And you know what I had noticed too, when she comes in, the smoke from her cigarette is like that greenish tinge to it.
Yep, we got that green color again coming up.
You know, so that's kind of like the evil color of you know, like the Maleficent type of, you know, fire color, smoke color.
Yeah.
And so the next scene, Bella, we go in and basically we're getting puppies.
Yep, another
lots of them.
Yeah,
birthing anticipation, worry.
Yeah,
Lady and the Tramp-esque, but not really.
Yeah, it was. That's true. I didn't even think about that till just now. Yeah, you're right. Where Pongo seems kind of okay, but it's the pet.
Like almost like he has no idea like what's going on. Like, oh, this is just what's going on, and Roger's the one like knows maybe like what could happen, so he's nervous.
Question to the crowd. Ryan, let's say you had a dog and you got, I don't know, say 15 puppies out of said dog. What would you do?
Yeah, those are going away. A lot of those are going away. Maybe one or two stick around. I'm not opening a plantation. That's for sure.
Yeah, oh my God, I love the end of this movie. It's so insane. The solution to the problem is madness. Absolute madness. Melissa, 15 puppies. What's going on here? In a London flat?
Honestly, two dogs is too much for me. So.
It's a lot.
I don't know. I mean, they're adorable when they're little, but...
They are adorable.
They're gippers.
They get big.
Especially those dogs.
I
was also impressed by the Mr. Miyagi type hand massage. That Roger uses to Frankenstein a puppy from the dead.
Is that lucky?
I thought he was kneading some pizza dough. I don't know what he was doing there.
Yeah, I believe that was lucky. Yeah, I assume that. They never actually say that, though, right? They never specifically say that it's lucky, but I just assumed it is because he was lucky to survive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right?
We'll go with it.
I'm pretty sure that's who it was,
I think so. Short of calling him the runt, I mean, that was about as close as they could get.
Yeah, exactly. I guess so, yeah. The next we see, you know, the puppies and everything, their mother and father are watching TV. Patch is absolutely a serial killer in training.
Whoa, we've missed that. We missed Cruella come back and try to steal all the dogs and Roger telling her off.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. That's right. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so they get the puppies back and she's like, you know, she appears at the door because apparently she knows exactly when the puppies are born. But there's lightning behind her. She's, you know, it's crashing. We had the clear villain, and she's wanting to write the check for the puppies. And you know, Roger, she again reminds Roger how poor he is, and he's like, "You're not taking these dogs. These don't belong to you. You'll not have them." And she flies off in a rage. Probably because the body's in the trunk at this point. and she storms out plotting, you know, or claiming that she will have her revenge. And that she and Anita are through.
I loved how he stood up to her, though, because he was like, his voice was very warbly and like, you know, it wasn't like the confident, like, "Nope, I'm going to stand my ground." It's like, I think you're not going to take them.
Yeah. He was standing his ground, but he was fighting to stand his ground.
Yeah.
Which is good because it made Cruella seem that more imposing. If he would have been able to kind of strong arm her out the door, I don't know if, I mean, I'm sure she still works as a villain, but it would have taken a little bit of points off of her chart, I think.
Yeah,
definitely. Would have taken some of that bite out of her if he was able to just push her off like that, you know, with not seeming like it was a difficult task on his part to even get the words out.
Yeah.
So what do we have next now? Now do we go to the scene where the puppies are all hanging out and stuff like that? Am I correct in that?
Yeah. They're watching TV.
They're watching TV. Some classic old school TV. And the neighbors must hate these people because there are like 17 dogs barking right now. Nuts. Absolutely nuts. I think the, you know, Incha setting up the ongoing gag that Lucky likes to stand in front of the TV was smart filmmaking.
Yeah, I like this. You know? It kind of went on a little long, but I thought it was great because you got to be introduced to certain, personalities of the dogs and like how they interact with each other and everything. So, and it was also like a little foreshadowing for the rest of the film.
Yeah, there's a couple of scenes where I felt that they were on a particular sequence a bit long, but the movie still moves along very quickly and is only 79 minutes. Mm-hmm. So without those, I don't know, it would have been like 72 minutes, something like that. Maybe it would have felt a little bit too short. Mm. But, you know, just hovering over that hour and 20 is kind of like a safer mark maybe for the animation at that point. So what do we have next, Mel? What happens?
You want to know the puppies we got introduced to?
Oh, my God. What, are you going to name them all?
No, there's only three of them.
Okay. Who do we get introduced to?
Well, you said Patch because he's like the terror.
Yeah,
he wants to kill everything.
He's going to murder things later in life. Yes, yeah. You should put him down.
Lucky loves to watch his TV, and
yes, he does.
Rolly's my spirit animal because he's always hungry. He's so cute and fat.
He was adorable. Yeah, I liked Rolly. He was adorable. But I'm happy that they didn't go too much into each and every one because then I kind of would have probably just lost track.
Yeah. Yeah,
yeah, it would have been way
too
much.
Give you enough. Yeah, they wanted to give you enough to kind of know that there was different dogs, and you see like Penny, the little girl dog, and like that. Okay, great. Now let's move on.
All right. So the real question is, how many of you went into the Disney store when you were little and went through all those stuffed animals with the collars to find all of those different Dalmatians?
I hate to say this. I did. Never once in my life did I do that.
I did not do that.
But I can see you doing that.
Aw, you guys are no fun.
It's because you're adorable. That's why. We're men. Man, I say. Manly man.
That's right.
Do you remember that when the Disney store used to have like that?
I threw the table over with all of them on it, and then I stepped on them.
Skin them in the store.
In the store.
Yeah, the Disney store used to have like that wall of like stuffed animals in front of the TV screen.
I don't remember what the Disney store used to. I remember the Disney store on Fifth Ave, I want to say, in New York City. It was like two or three stories large, and the top floor was nothing but art and animated cells. And I absolutely loved it, and I miss those stores.
No. Me and my sister would go to the stuffed animals because it was right in front of like the big movie screen that they would have all the old, you know, cartoons and movies playing, and we just dig through the stuffed animals. And when this was re-released again in the 1991, it was like the perfect time for us to just dig through and try and find all the Dalmatians.
They did the same thing with McDonald's, didn't they? Like McDonald's had all, like you could collect 101 of the puppies. I can't remember. I think there was something like that.
Was that for the live action one?
I can't remember.
It might have
been. It could have been either way. Yeah.
That was in 96.
Yeah, not too far off.
So next we get what? We get Horace and Jasper because the dogs are going out for their walk and we're introduced to our henchmen as they're sort of lying in wait.
Are these the predecessors to Home Alone, the henchmen in Home Alone?
Yes.
Joe Pesci and what's his name? Daniel Stern.
Yeah, why not? Pretty much.
As soon as I saw them, that's what I kind of pictured in my head.
If you reverse the personalities on the physicalities of them, then they're the same guys. The only thing is that they're pretty good at what they do, actually.
Yeah, they're actually efficient for the most part.
I love how Horace, though, he says stuff and he is actually saying like what's happening. Like he's like, well, maybe they disguise themselves, and Jasper's like, no, they wouldn't do that. It's like, no, that's what they did.
He also is a little hesitant.
Yeah,
he doesn't
want to get captured again.
Yeah, because they've already got two strikes on him. Is that what he says?
Yeah, I think it's more that he doesn't want to get a third strike rather than he doesn't think they should skin 99 puppies. I think that's where his...
At this point, they already captured, what would be the math, 84 of them.
Well, no, they all came from...
Yeah, other pens and stuff. But, like, the thing is, like, they already know the deed at hand.
Oh, yes.
And they
have
84 of them in waiting. So, I mean, if he was hesitant about doing it, he's definitely been hesitant for a while because that's a lot of dogs to collect and to have all in the same age. You know what? That doesn't make a lot of sense. Don't worry about that, though.
Well, there's a lot of
puppies. That's an awful lot of Dalmatians going on in one area.
That's to be found in one area.
Well, I guess if they all give birth to like 15 or 16 at a time.
Or if they're just like hanging around firehouse stations because that's where I believe all Dalmatians live. That's what I've been told in life. And I'm pretty sure it's 100% accurate.
Maybe.
Not maybe. That's the reality of life. Puppies stolen, made, accosted, like kind of violently, but also kind of easily. Horace has doubts. Cruella calls the house. Not sure why. I don't know why I put that down. Oh, that's why. That's when they get to the other house, I guess, and Cruella calls them. Or they call Cruella and she's like, why are you calling me on this line? It's such like a crime film thing to say. But I thought it was cool because she was like aware of the fact that they had just been investigated. And like, I guess Scotland Yard could be tapping their lines. I really thought that was strangely sharp.
Yeah.
You know, like I don't know why. I didn't expect that line to come out of her. And it's I was like, I was like, all right. She's actually thinking this through, partially. The other part, not so much.
Oh, yeah.
So what happens next? Ryan, where do we go from here? So now the puppies are stolen. The news goes out and about. And the parents of the pups are seemingly lost. But they start to think up a plan, at least Pongo does, of what could help them.
Yes, we get the Twilight Bark.
Yes, also known as the Beacons of Minas Tirith. That's what I thought of anyway when I was doing it. So what exactly is the Twilight Bark?
So we get the humans, the pets have done everything they can. So now it's up to the dogs. And he has this idea to activate the Twilight Bark. Perdita is a little skeptical because that's really just a gossip line. but they decide on their walk, they're going to try to send out a signal to let dogs everywhere in the city know that the puppies have been stolen and see if they can help locate where they are in the city. And this is a great scene because we get to meet some characters that we've missed for a couple of years. We get Jock from Lady and the Tramp. We get Peggy, and we get the Pit Bull from Lady and Tramp. They're all sending along this signal in London. Everyone's getting in trouble. You know, it's like that Zootopia scene. They started to howl. They just started to howl, and it goes until we get out to the countryside, where there are we have our goose, we have an old hound, and they're sending it along to the colonel, who may or may not have misinterpreted the signal.
Yeah, and even you know what though, even just a step before that, we get the non-stupid version of Scooby-Doo.
the great thing.
Looked exactly. I was like, oh my God, he is the non-dumb version of Scooby-Doo. Well, and then, yeah. Oh, go ahead.
It doesn't. Because this kind of happens in Lady and the Tramp, too, with the telephone of barking dogs, right?
Oh, you mean Lady and the Tramp T-O-O or T-W-O?
No, T-O. Like, also.
Oh, okay. I just want to make sure.
Yeah, no.
Does that? I don't remember.
I thought so because, I'm pretty sure it does. I was like
right at the end where they're trying to stop the dog catcher from taking Tramp.
Yeah, and they're like trying to get everyone to know like this is what's going on. Yeah. So like it kind of brought me back to this again, and instead of it being the howling Twilight dog, Bark. No, why am I blanking on everybody's name? Who is Jock's friend?
Trusty.
So it was like the great Dane. It was like that deep, like.
Yeah, I actually, when I first saw like a great Dane, I was like, oh, is it going to be the same voice? But then we got Towser. Was that his name?
Towser and Lucy the Goose.
Yeah, Towser and Lucy the Goose. And they alert the Colonel, who I kind of loved.
Who is saved by the best character ever.
But wait, I want to just point out, one of my favorite pieces of animation in the entire film is when the Colonel is communicating back, the goose is holding up Towser's ear.
Yeah.
That I think was my favorite visual gag in the entire film, and it only happens for like 2-3 seconds, but I really got a kick out of that. Melissa, who did they get introduced to?
Sergeant Tibbs.
When did They Call Me Mr. Tibbs come out?
I don't know.
They call me Mr. Tibbs.
I just love how the cat is the one that's like interpreting the barks when the colonel gets it wrong.
Yeah, it is good. Oh, keep going.
So they have
67 based off of the 65 novel.
Ah. Oh, I've got 1970 for They Call Me Mr. Tibbs. Oh, because it was a sequel to the 67 film In the Heat of the Night where he actually said the line. Ha!
Yes.
Well done. Call me Mr. Tibbs.
So when they were writing that movie, they thought of the cat.
Exactly.
They thought of the cat.
Yeah, they just thought he was the coolest cat in town, and they were like, I've got it, guys. Guys, I've got it.
Because they're so, because Sergeant Tibbs and Mr. Tibbs are really so much alike.
Yeah, I cracked the code. It's all right there, guys. It's all right there. All right, so
this sequence was long. Yeah, well,
the communication between Towser and Colonel, I thought was kind of lengthy
because he keeps misinterpreting it.
So. Yeah, I know. But it just, for me, I didn't mind it, but I was like, oh, this is going on for a while.
I think I zoned out on this part.
Oh, okay. Well, guess what happened?
To be honest,
they figured it out.
Well, this was one of the differences between the novel and the film.
Well, tell me.
They changed the name to Hell Hall for the movie.
Yeah, but that's good. I mean, look, if you're going to go with the whole Devil DeVille joke, just take it and just run the whole distance of the field.
No, yeah, it's good.
You know, I mean, have a cat named Satan. Just do things.
Yeah. The original song from Cruella DeVille was Cruel Devil, and like they kept working that through it. So. Yeah, they had it throughout, and then they kind of took some pieces away. But
yeah, but it still lives in there. Actually, in the book, I believe she also had a cat. And in the book, she was skinning the kitten litters that her cat was making, and then the cat helps the Dalmatians escape later. Strangely, that didn't make it into the film. Can't understand why. I think there was also some playful petting between three dogs in the book, which was not made into the final film. Again, who would have thunk it? all right, so 99 Dalmatians are all living in Hell House. Right? Hell Home? Hell House?
Hell Hall.
Hell House is another movie.
Yeah. You are just all over the place.
I am all over the map. This cold is making things awesome. That must be the filthiest room of all time, because I don't think Jasper and Horace are cleaning up after these dogs, and there are 99 of them. That is disgusting and gross.
Oh, yeah. Ugh. I didn't even think of that, yeah.
No.
Yeah, not good. Not good at all.
And the house is, like, falling apart around them.
But the TV works.
The TV works. Most important part.
Works without a hitch.
There's some good reception on that TV also.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they have wine, so, you know.
Yeah, can't go wrong.
They're good spirits.
The house kind of reminded me of the house in Fight Club that they wind up squatting in. Like, that's what it reminded me of. So, okay, so they put together, oh, my God, there were dogs we heard in this house. They go, they find out, and a message is relayed all the way back to Pongo. And they're going to, like, hey, I can't tell you in this message, but meet me on Primrose Hill, which would drive me nuts. I'd be like, just tell me, because I'm listening right now. So what happens next? We have a meeting at Primrose Hill. Ryan, take it away.
And so they're told that, you know, they're out in the country and that, you know, you need to go this way, follow the Twilight Bark, and they'll get you back to the Colonel, who can show you where your puppies are. And so then we get the traveling dog show.
Yeah. Yeah. And they go through hardships and,
Which is interesting, because like their journey there didn't seem as long as their journey back.
Well, I think that makes sense because they're I mean, when we get to that, like a spoiler alert, but you know, when they're going back, they are having 99 puppies trailing them. That would make a go slower. We've been through Disney with the two of us and with a kid.
That's true.
And how big does that one kid make a difference? Now imagine there were 99 of them. I'd be skinning them. Make me a baby coat. Oh my God.
That's disturbing.
It is disturbing, but I'm a big Ed Gein fan, folks. Don't look that up unless you really want to have nightmares.
Now, and this is where also, like, you get the scene of Cruella being, like laying out the actual plan. Like, we got to kill them.
It takes a while for this plan to come out.
And then all the gruesome ways on how they can do that is, it's a little disturbing.
It's a little disturbing, but you know what? It makes her dangerous. I'm okay with this. I don't think that this is out of line. I don't think that it's too much. I think it's fine. I think it's make a villain. Don't bite back so much just because it's an animated film. I think this is fine.
No, I know, but
there's no visuals for it either. It's just the descriptions, and so it's left to your imagination.
Yeah. If she was doing like some Maleficent stuff and like magic was coming up and it was showing how they would do it, then I'd be like, oh wow, this is dark.
A little dark.
Yeah. You know what that is? That's The Secret of NIMH, which would come out later in the '80s and haunt everyone's dreams. Thank you, Don Bluth.
But do you think something like this would even fly today. Like, even just the description of...
Oh, man. People suck so bad today.
Like, I don't think you can get away with it. Like Brian, not. Like, how many times has something like this been shown in, like, anything that Kyle watches? Like, or mentioned?
I would only say... The only thing I could think of, Bri, because I know he's a big fan of it, is... But they don't show it, but, I mean, obviously he figures it out. When Anakin kills all the children in the Jedi Temple.
Yeah.
That would be pretty good.
Pretty much it. Yeah, because, I mean, you got to realize it's not just even skinning animals. It's skinning puppies. So it's like it's like clubbing baby seals. Like it's even worse.
Yeah.
I can't think of anything at all, honestly, that has something like that nowadays.
Yeah. Unless he just watches The Cove, which is a documentary. Don't worry about it, Melissa. Don't worry about it. I watched such a great documentary yesterday/today called Talk to Me, Marlon. And this is a little side note for everyone. It's on Showtime On Demand. And
was
I
he
guess
trying
otherwise.
To find his son? Oh, yeah.
What?
Don't worry about
it. All right. So it was a documentary about Marlon Brando, but it was purely done in recordings of himself that he used to make all the time. And so you basically went through the life of Marlon Brando through the words of Marlon Brando. And it was absolutely fantastic. The man was a fascinating figure. And he really stood up for a lot of things that got him nothing but hardship. And he would just go back and keep defending it. You know, like defending people who were just being stomped on. And he would then in turn, like, you know, be villainized. And I don't know. I just don't know anyone of his size of a stature that took on that stuff at such a rough time in American history and just, you know, was not appreciated for all the stuff that he did do during his life. And then he just had some horrible things happen later in life, but it was fascinating. Talk to Me, Marlon. You should check that out if you're a film fan at all. I think it's almost required watching, actually. I would put it on that list. So, Cruella wants these puppies to be skinned. And Horace and Jasper are like, you know what? Job's a job, folks. We got to get this plot rolling. So they look for heavy things to beat up puppies with. This was kind of disturbing, too.
Uh-huh.
I like how they argued about who was going to do the beating.
Yeah. It reminded me of something else. I can't think of it. Oh, my God. I just thought of it. It reminded me of in Pulp Fiction when Marvin gets his head blown off and they have an argument about who should clean up the bone in the brain because you're the one who shot him. Why am I on brain detail? I believe was the line. So, well, with some extra words thrown in there. So the puppies, though, they escape with the help of?
Sergeant Tibbs.
Sergeant Tibbs comes in there, gets all the dogs, except Lucky, of course, who kind of... It takes him a little while to get him in there, but it's the fat one who causes the trouble.
Rolly.
Yeah. Rolly can't fit through the thing. Rolly also can't not slide on ice, I guess, on a flat surface.
He can't make it up the stairs. Yeah, he's got lots of problems.
He's got a lot of issues. But
yeah,
again,
he's always hungry.
Yeah, he is.
He's so cute.
Take us through while I have a coughing fit.
Don't have a coughing fit. Yes, so they're escaping, and I thought that the hole led outside, but apparently it just led to another part of the house. So the puppies, like, wind up hiding upstairs, Horace and Jasper looking for them. And eventually, the cat makes it where they're all in the room, but they are cornered. Mm. And then you get the grand entrance of Pongo and Perdita to come save the day.
And they do. They do a good job. They fight off the bad guys. Mom and Dad save the day. And, you know, basically all the puppies, all of them now, are going to head back to London. Because how could you leave 84 puppies to their death? You can't. Well, you could. But it's a bad choice. It's the wrong choice. It's the wrong choice. But the trip back to London is harsh. And they definitely made this seem not easy in the film, which is good. I think it's good to show characters overcoming, like, real things that seem legitimately dangerous. Like, a lot of times in films now, you never feel that your characters are actually in danger. You know, there's something going on, but you're like, they'll just get through it. This, I was, because of the way that they teased one of the puppies dying early in the film, I kind of wondered if one of the nameless sort of puppies that they just picked up would get lost in the mix here. Not that it would fit the math, literally, of the movie, but at least I felt that there was some danger to these characters. Ryan, did you also feel that they were actually in legitimate danger?
Yeah, I do, especially when you get to the elements and, you know, yes, they've gotten across the ice. They've escaped from the bumbling, you know, guys who – well, that's not true. They were really great at their job at one point, and they somehow turned into bumbling idiots at some other – you know, somewhere in that interim.
Yeah, true.
But they've gotten away from that. But it's the elements that, you know, really get bad. When you get that, you know, that really hard-blowing wind, you have all these snowdrifts that are as big as some of these puppies. Like, that's a – you know, you can see how tired even the adult dogs are. There's a definite concern there.
But even Horace, like, he still, like, maintains his, like, smartness, for lack of a better word. Like, he was like, oh, they probably went on the ice to hide their tracks,
yeah,
which is what they did. And then yeah, Jasper's like, no. So, yeah, it's like they're bumbling but not 100%. I think it's just because Jasper is, like, the leader and he's the one who's, like, really dumb. Horace is smart.
Yeah, he seems to pick up on stuff, but
he thinks like a dog very well.
Thinks like a dog.
Yeah.
Then Lassie saves the day, which is good. Lassie, Collie finds him, brings him to a shelter with a dairy barn, and then 99 dogs just go at it with the cows.
Well, the cows offer to feed them.
So weird. Am I the only one who thought this was weird?
No, it's weird.
It's weird, right? It's Brian? Weird.
Oh, it was real.
It's
weird.
A little weird. It's just a smidge weird, because yeah. I mean, I was expecting like just a saucer of milk to be standing somewhere.
Yeah,
I don't know.
You know, there's some bottles of milk in the corner or something. I don't know.
Meanwhile, the collie got Pongo a hero. It's like, what the hell is going on here?
And I love it the whole time, like while we're watching the poor puppies, like it's like intercut with like, you don't get too sad because of the puppy situation, because then you have like Cruella, like a mad woman driving around in the snow in that car.
Yeah.
She got amazing tires. That's all I know.
Yeah. No, that car is ridiculous.
Yeah.
I can't get out of my driveway half the time, you know, in a modern car. Meanwhile.
Yeah. She is like whipping along backcountry roads.
She's in a roadster and she's getting out of like 5 foot ditches. High drifts. Yeah. And ditches. Yeah.
Well, all of a sudden, it turns into a Mad Max car later on in the movie.
I loved that so much. Yeah, let's get to that, because, man, this movie sort of does go on for a while.
It's definitely the long escape.
Yeah, it's a long escape, but it's good. I mean,
no, it's good. If you're it didn't feel like it dragged or anything.
Yeah, no. I felt like it was good. So, yeah, the collie saves the day over at the dairy barn, and then we have the whole sequence where they cover themselves in soot, which, all right, this was the only part where I was like, do you normally see like 15 to 20 puppies walking across each other and only the collie
exactly
would throw you off?
Yeah.
But, you know, hey, it worked in Predator, so it can work here too.
I mean, if they were ducks, I can understand that because you see that all the time. But usually,
all the time.
I don't think you usually see tons of puppies.
Yeah.
Well, where I work,
it
where
was
I
Canadian
work,
geese,
do,
yeah.
There's ducks nonstop crossing the street.
100%.
So, yeah, that seemed, but it was fun though, also. It was kind of fun. You know, I liked, you know, we can get dirty. Like, you want us to get dirty? I thought that was kind of fun.
Yeah.
Well, and then you get the dog that's going, you know, we're going to fool the old mad lady. And I'm like,
yeah.
Okay, great. Let's go.
Huge car sequence. Race thing goes on. No, words. What's the words I'm looking for? Chase scene with two cars.
Car chase, yep.
That poor man who's just trying to transport some chairs.
Yeah, some furniture.
He must be wondering, like, what in the hell is wrong with everybody?
Yeah.
Like, well, what is going on?
No way. He didn't really, but he was not the best because he did not secure any of that furniture back there. He left that back door wide open.
That's a good point.
You know what I
mean?
He
did leave with that door wide open. That's a good point. Yeah.
And it wasn't even like they opened the door.
They didn't open
like
it.
Once they show you that car, the truck for the first time, that door is wide open the whole time.
It's like our moving company. It's fine.
He got his repairs and he got out of town.
So, yeah, her car turns into a demon car, which is great. Yeah. I absolutely love the visual.
And the animation of her with the crazy eyes.
That's my nominee
right there. I didn't remember
the
car doing that. So when that happened, I was like, oh, I like that.
I want a figure like that. That'd be cool. Like, why isn't that version? Well, because they didn't do a lot of things right in Disney Infinity. But, like, that should have been a car version. I don't know if it is. I don't believe so. That you could get in Disney Infinity. Because that would be so great. That would have been so cool. Drive with Stitch at the wheel at that thing. Ah, would have been so awesome. Actually, we should maybe talk about Stitch at the end. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Stitch at the end.
Oh, yeah, we can talk about it.
Okay, so the dogs return home. This is the second time I got to make an Al Jolson reference, but yeah, the dogs get home.
I love this, though. Like, the poor nanny, she's just so sad because the dogs are gone.
Well, it's her fault. That's why.
She got accosted.
Yeah, she shouldn't have opened the door.
Shouldn't open the door. Yeah, don't, you
don't open the door for people. That's the other thing that's stupid about this American Horror Story thing. Don't open doors for people.
Yeah,
I don't care. I don't care what they look like. Just don't open doors. If you're inside, stay inside. You want to go outside and have your life at ease? Well, there you go. Don't open doors.
He's from the electric company.
Yeah, it said the gas company. Yeah, it signed for it. It said so. So the dogs get home just in time for Christmas. And they make a Dalmatian plantation.
It'll be a sensation.
I forgot that song even existed.
Did anybody else find it weird when we have Roger going, you know, how did all these puppies happen? And he's like, Pongo.
Yeah.
Like, it's been a week. Like, how do you think this
happened? Poor Purdy.
Right.
I mean, she would, Jesus. You know what? I hadn't seen this movie in a long time. And I remembered the 99 not happening at the end of the movie, but happening during the birthing scene. And I legitimately was like, how does this make any sense? Like when it was about to happen in the film. And they stopped at 15 and then my brain started kicking and I was like, oh, wait a minute. They're not all there. So like, yeah, they just take them in later. But yeah, for a little while there, I was wondering how science worked.
Yeah, because I had forgotten that also. So I was thinking the same thing. Yeah. I was like,
because if Purdy gave birth to 99 puppies, I mean, she would look like Violet Beauregard, just filled with puppies instead of blueberries. Side note, Roger owes Cruella de Vil royalties, and a lot of them, and she should sue their family and make them broke.
Yeah, well, technically, they stole 84 puppies from her. I mean, she paid for 84 of them legitimately.
I do not have any. Yeah, they also stole. Yeah, that's a good point. Stole property. And he's using her likeness in a song. It cannot be denied. He's literally singing about her. It's a huge hit. She deserves royalties, and she has to be – she has a countersue. I mean, yeah, she's going to be, you know, sued for stealing 15. But if she's the bad guy for stealing 15, I mean, who's this guy for stealing 84?
Well, was
who's
he
the
stealing
real villain?
Them, or was he, you like, know what adopting it means?
Who owned them?
No one.
No, she bought them from shelters.
You really think
so.
She bought them or she got them?
I don't know. Got? Okay, that's a good point. I'm not sure what they meant by got.
Oh, yeah. That is true. Okay.
Yeah.
But the dogs seem pretty cool with it. They're like, no, they got us from a shelter. I don't know if that was a voice, but it was close.
Doesn't sound like it.
That's, no, that sounded like Borat.
Yeah. We don't. What? We don't actually have one of the Dalmatians in the studio, just so everyone knows, because I know how close that was to actually.
We don't have a
voice.
Studio.
We don't have a studio either.
You're ridiculous.
I just have a sizable desk. That's what we have. A sizable desk. So yeah, that's our movie.
Ta-da!
Bye bye.
It was interesting.
It was interesting.
I do really like this movie.
Isn't that the end? Isn't that the last question?
No. I just want to say, because the villain in it, I feel, has been portrayed the best in Once Upon a Time.
Wait, seriously?
Yeah.
Like, legitimately, they did a good job of her
they
in
did
Once
a really
Upon a
good
Time?
Job. The actress is really good.
What the hell is going on over here? All right, folks. This is some rock and roll playing right now.
What the heck is that?
I don't know how that happened. Oh, my God. I know how it happened. I don't know what words you said, but I just by accident activated Siri on my phone, and then it started playing a Clutch song. So the combination of words that you said out loud must have sent off for idiot Siri to play a song by Clutch. You maniac. Cruella yes, we're getting to the bottom of this.
Okay. But right, yeah, so, no, in the show, she's really good.
Well, that's good.
And they
for
do
a
good, you know, thing of with her car and stuff. And I really like the actress with it.
Didn't she also, don't they actually play the song in the background when she's like introduced and she actually makes a mention of like, oh, I like the song?
Yeah. And she, it, like in one of her storylines, like she's transported to like a jazz bar kind of thing with the author.
Jazz flute?
Pretty good. She was from that era.
Did they play jazz flute?
No.
No?
I don't think so.
It's Ron Burgundy there?
She takes over when Hades gets kicked out, though.
Like the jazz bar?
No. Oh. It's not really hell, but it's wherever Hades is, so.
Isn't that the underworld?
Yeah.
Because the underworld isn't really hell. It's the underworld.
Yeah.
So, all right. So
it's the upside down of story.
So they run a jazz bar in the underworld, and it's called Hades. Is that everything? Did I get that right?
No.
Okay.
Everyone is now yelling at their at their radio at you. I just want you to know that.
And I want to ask everyone who has a radio, what year do you live in?
Well, you listen to your podcast through the radio in your car.
Well, all right. Okay. On that one. That was a very, I just went into a very Cesar Romero Joker laugh. It's like, all right. Dude, Melissa.
Off the rails. Tonight.
We have three questions to be asked of thy film. What is these questions asked?
You're a wackadoodle. We're going to ask if the film still holds up. We're going to pick the iconic shot of the scene of the movie.
Iconic shot.
And yeah. And then we're going to see if it's a morals film or an emotional film.
Let's start with that. I like starting with the morals of the message one. Ryan Wilson, man of the Gazette. Speaker of worlds, is 101 Dalmatians a message for the ages, or is it trying to get an emotional response from you? Tell me your answers.
I think I can't even. I was gonna try to do Mason, and that's not gonna work. So it's an emotional film. You know, it tugs at your heartstrings. You have all these dogs. You don't want them to get hurt. As a caveat. In looking back at this, around the same time they released the stellar Selena Gomez version of the song, they also made a anti-smoking commercial with all of the animation from the film. So apparently, you know, 50 years later, they found a moral to go with the story.
Don't smoke.
But don't smoke. You turn into a crazy mad lady. But I'm going to go with it's an emotional story.
Brian Bogad, what do you think about this?
I would have to go with an emotional story also. I mean, the only moral would maybe be don't open the door for anyone who just says they work for, like, the oil company or the electric company, whatever it is that they work for.
Yes.
Other than that, yeah, I can't think of any morals that this movie was trying to get across. I think it was just like Brian said, it was an emotional thing. It was, you know, I guess maybe like the parents trying to get, you know, with the losing the kids and leaving the puppies, I should say. And that was basically it. It was just a kind of like a feel good movie at the end with, you know, them all getting back and Cruella crashing and yeah, that's about it. I don't think there was much behind this other than, you know, a fun story.
Okay. Melissa.
Did Cruella die?
No, they're on mode because the three of them just like were like, car crashes.
Yeah, they were all just sitting around like
crying.
Yeah. It was pretty much like playing the video game Outrun.
Oh, so see, airbags, you know, you don't need them. Or seatbelts for that
matter.
It's
in the 60s.
I know.
You're lucky these people weren't doing cocaine while driving.
She kind of looked a little bit like...
Did you see her face? I don't know.
That's a good point, actually. Yeah, it may have been.
Yeah, I think it's an emotional, you know... Good time.
An emotional roller coaster.
Yeah, it's an emotional roller coaster. You have a good time, then you feel sad, then you're happy again. And then you got a plantation.
I'm going to... because plantations have all the positive things associated with it. I'm going to say...
Is that like the same thing as a puppy mill then? Because they're going...
Yeah, pretty much. What we don't know is that this is really... It's the first puppy mill.
Okay.
That's what they open.
Okay.
This story gets dark later. I will say, I think there was a little bit of a moral. I think that this movie was definitely making a comment towards furs.
Well, yeah.
I mean, I think that that was a conscious decision to make a film that was talking about, you know, skinning animals, you know, for their furs, you know, just for vanity.
Was that a thing in like the 60s? Did that start then?
I'm sure it did. Like yeah, I'll throw some blood at people in the past.
Like,
yeah, why not?
Like, that was like the hippies, or was that the 70s? That was the 60s. Right? I don't know.
It was always. There's always been a time when people were like, hey, that's probably not the, that's kind of messed up, you know?
Yeah.
Also, the 60s did have that very anti-high establishment feel, which was, you know, which would have been the hippies and whatnot.
Okay.
So, yeah, no, I absolutely think that that's, I think that's part of it. I don't think it's their main drive. I think the main drive is, you know, family strength. The strength of family triumphs over evil.
Yeah. And you know what? So, they're kind of hippie themselves, like in a weird way. Like they're gonna, you know, he's a musician.
Yeah.
And she reads, and they're going to go move out into the country with 101 dogs and just like live off the land, man.
Yeah.
Like that type of
man,
thing. You know?
I'm just gonna. Yeah. I had a hit song, man. Let's buy this farm. And do you know how to farm? Not at all, man. But the dogs will be able to do it. And then you know, then they eat the dogs.
Exactly.
I don't know. Maybe. I don't know. Melissa Mignone.
Not anymore.
Whatever. Going back to the past. What?
Yeah. Oh, no.
Let's go with... Oh, you know what? Never mind. I'm so sorry. What a stupid idea that was. Brian, let me go with you, actually, for the iconic shot.
Speaking of Cruella de Vil looking cracked out, that's going to be my iconic shot. The one with her, the crazy red eyes, her hair is just... Like she stuck it in a light socket, and
she looks
that's
good.
To me. That yeah, she does. That's the shot to me that I always that stands out to me from that.
Ryan,
I always tend to lean towards the first time we see all the puppies as you know they've aged up a little bit. They're watching television. We have the one sitting there. We have mom and dad in the back. That's kind of the shot I always think of when I think of this movie.
I am going to mirror Brian's response. I'm going to say that the thing that stuck with me, and I guess I remembered even previous to the film, was that shot of Cruella driving towards the camera with eyes going nuts and all ready to murder, like literally just murder.
Yeah, those are murder eyes. Yeah, yeah.
Murder eyes.
Yeah.
All right.
I've seen those once or twice, yeah.
I'm sorry, folks. I have to get to this eventually. Melissa, what is your iconic shot?
What's your iconic 15-minute section of the movie?
Well, go. I like the part where they're getting married and the dogs like put their paws over each other and the dogs get married. I think that's really cute.
That's a sequence.
No, it's not. The dog's just having their paws up like in the little arch.
Is it one shot?
Yeah. But that's not my favorite. Okay. I just like that one. I think the iconic one, I like the one that Ryan said, like when you see all the puppies and you have the ones like on the armchair and you have the parents, the one sitting on Pongo's head for some odd reason.
Because it's awesome.
So yeah, that like family shot of the dogs. I like it.
Okay. Wow, that was painless. Until Melissa knocked her elbow into the table. Yes. Mysterious ways, folks. Mysterious ways.
Shut up.
Finally, Melissa, we'll start with you on this one. Does this film hold up?
I think so. I think the pacing, you know, it didn't feel long. It never really dragged, even though there were some parts that were like, you know, we said they felt like they went on a little long. It never felt like, all right, get on with it, like we've had with some other films. So
get on with it.
And I think, like, even though it's more specific time, you know, frame that they're pointing to, I still think it's a classic. So
okay. Bonus points to anyone who got that Monty Python reference. Brian.
I think it definitely still holds up. I think Cruella is just a villain for all time. She's, you know, she works any time. She works then, she works now. The only thing that would, to me, would be like the dated is like maybe kids today wouldn't even know what a fur coat is, you know?
I don't know.
You know what I'm saying? That's the only thing I could think of where they would be like, what is a fur coat?
Let me tell you. I'll explain it to you in great detail.
I'll show you.
give me a dog.
Go get the dog. I think it's a fun movie. It's got a good pace to it. It's something like we've said throughout, some sections maybe dragged a little bit, but not to the point where I was looking at the clock.
Never.
Let's get moving.
Never.
Yeah, no. And I think it's just a fun movie. The characters are fun. All the dogs are adorable. And I think it definitely holds up.
Okay. I will say I think yes. I think it holds up. It moves quickly enough. It seems dangerous for the puppies. It has a memorable song that still works if just released today. The animation is a nice change of pace, even if it, quote-unquote, is a little sloppier. I wouldn't even say that it is. It just has a different vibe than the other Disney films, and I liked it. I liked this change of pace to all of the fancy and fairy tale that we've had before. I thought this was a good time for this film to come out. So that is my thought on it. Ryan, what are your thoughts on, does this film hold up?
Yeah, I think it does. I think it's, you know, it definitely sets a period. Like, you know exactly you're not in today. You're in, you know, back in the 60s. But you have it's a great story. It's a short distance, you know, especially kids nowadays. You know, people don't want them in front of the screens as long, or they, you know, the attention spans aren't quite there. Mm-hmm. 75 minutes, you can get in, get out, be done. And kids, you know, kids and puppies, they go together. So I think it holds.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a nice unanimous decision that we all feel this holds up. So a good start to the animated films of the 1960s.
Yes,
as this was our first one. Let's talk really briefly about some news that came out today about Lilo and Stitch.
Well,
in particular, Stitch's Great Escape in Magic Kingdom.
No Lilo.
Oh my God.
Poor Lilo.
Sometimes I wish I was a honky tonk man and I just had like a lot of spare guitars.
I wish that too sometimes.
To like hit you over the head with. It'd be so great. And then I would do like a little honky tonk dance.
I just want to see you in a jumpsuit.
All right. So, Melissa, what's going on now with Stitch's Great Escape?
It's only going to be open seasonally.
What does that mean?
It's like on demand.
No, you gotta demand it. What that means?
You gotta demand it. And no one's going to demand it.
It's going to be like that taco place across from Pirates of the Caribbean.
Oh, yeah, but I really want that place to be open because they changed the menu. I really want to try it.
I'm trying to think of what the last ride that I in Magic Kingdom that was seasonal. I want to say it was the Timekeeper.
Timekeeper, yeah.
Is that right? Oh, my goodness. Yep. Ryan, is this a death toll for this attraction?
Yes. Effectively, it is. And, you know, we've all talked about Tomorrowland's the next land of Magic Kingdom that needs help.
Yeah.
And so I think this is the first move towards that. You know, but the Timekeeper went seasonal, but this is going to take a while. Seasonal for years and years and years.
It was seasonal until, for a long time.
Right. Until basically they said it was seasonal, but it just didn't open for, you know, several years. So yeah, this is pretty much the end of the road for Stitch.
Yeah.
Well, they painted the rocks in Tomorrowland blue, so they're already refurbing that whole place.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess so. That's where it starts.
That's where it starts.
It's a whole new experience.
Retheming the entire place.
Once the blue rocks come in, everything's gone.
Never know. They're just really huge pop rocks. If you throw Coke at them, they just explode. You know what? This is a
lazily
put together attraction from the beginning on a movie that deserves a lot better. I would hope that we would see Stitch in an attraction that is worthy of the quality of that film, and I think the fun of that character. This was just not the way to go. Alien Encounter was much cooler. It had it had its own vibe. It was unlike anything else in the Magic Kingdom, and I think I don't know if it would probably seem pretty corny and silly now, but
no, it was terrifying.
No, I know. I'm just saying I don't know if it would. You know, if it
I don't
would
think
work, no,
it would fit. But
yeah, so I don't know what they're going to do next. I know there's a lot
of
rumors.
If you want to keep Stitch's Great Escape, like, why don't we actually make like an escape in like his rocket ship and like do like a really cool like VR thing or I don't know, like a.
Here's my thing with that because it doesn't take place in the Land of Tomorrow.
Well, I'm not saying it necessarily has to be in Tomorrow.
Problem. Yeah, and that's the thing. That's Tomorrowland's biggest problem. Like, you all know I'm a huge fan of Wreck-It Ralph, and I would love to see something with Sugar Rush happen, especially with that, you know, insanely antiquated Speedway.
No,
but,
it's a Speedway of Tomorrow.
It's the Speedway of Tomorrow with
self-driving
engines
cars
that were built in the 70s.
Go-karts from, like, 30 years ago,
you know,
40 years ago.
As much as I would love to see something like that, it has nothing to do with the Land of Tomorrow.
No, yeah.
It really doesn't.
They need to retheme that. Just like, you know, Epcot's theme isn't really there like it was anymore. Like, they need to focus again.
So, you know, as much as I've said, like, I would love to see a Sugar Rush attraction and, you know, rumors of rumors and of, you know, blah, blah, blah. It doesn't fit the theme at all. Tron can fit the theme because you can make it, you know, you're living in the computer of tomorrow, something like that. But I guess you can kind of stretch that with Wreck-It Ralph as well. It definitely will look futuristic. You can make Sugar Rush feel very futuristic.
With all the candy?
Yep, because candy is nothing but futuristic. It does not exist in the past. So.
And it will be there tomorrow.
Exactly. Because that stuff does not dissolve.
But yeah. I definitely, I think we're all, it's all kind of obvious. Like, this is finally the death knell for that attraction. It is long overdue, but it's understandable with all the other things they've been doing that it hasn't really been a priority. But Tomorrowland needs to become a priority after some other things are taken care of and whatnot.
Yeah, you can't close that right now, though.
Could you, though? I guess not.
No, I meant like Tomorrowland, like not just one attraction.
Melissa. Yeah, but like when you guys go through there, is there anything that you hit up? Like, I mean, I know I do Space Mountain, and they used to have the cream cheese pretzel there that they don't have anymore. At the thing, the needle, the
launching pad,
the launching pad. Yeah, they used to have that, and when it went in June, they didn't have it anymore. And I was sad because I was really tasting it, and it wasn't there anymore.
I mean, I guess it's a good question to throw at Ryan, because Ryan, you just came down here, and I mean, what was the main? Actually, by the way,
I do TTA and Carousel Progress also. But other than those three things, I don't really hit anything up.
No, that front corridor is something I avoid like the plague, and I'll just be honest. I do Space Mountain, I do the People Mover, I do Carousel Progress, and I'll hit Buzz Lightyear. Especially if it's a short line, but the Monsters, Inc. and Stitch, I've for a long time not thought that they really felt like Tomorrowland. They didn't fit as far as I was concerned. And so I kind of bypass those as quickly as I can.
Yeah, I do. I walk right past them, which actually, I just want to make a quick comment. Dude, it was awesome to finally meet you in person.
Yes, it was great to finally see everyone in person.
That was so funny to me because when I posted up a picture of a number of us, we had someone ask a question like, oh, do you guys only hang out at Disney? Are you friends like outside? And I explained, like, this was the first time that me and Ryan and Mel and Ryan have ever met.
Yeah.
You know, like, the flat out reasoning is we didn't know each other before we started doing this show together. The first time I ever spoke to Ryan was when we recorded the first night that he was on the show.
Yep.
That was it. Like, we never had a discussion before anything, even with, you know, him being on WDW and all that kind of, you know, connection and whatnot. It just never happened.
Don't really live close. Like, now that Disney's here, we're here. It's easier.
Yeah, now that we're here, everyone comes to visit us. It's kind of awesome. But it was really cool, like, actually meeting you and hanging out with you guys for the day. And, actually, I have a funny story to tell you.
Yeah, really it sounds quick. Like it was a great time.
It was a great time. You want to know, Ryan? Because you weren't there. That's why. I'm showing my phone right now to Ryan. And if you notice...
I notice.
Okay.
I notice.
So I got the new iPhone 7, and within 24 hours, I dropped it on the ground. I had owned the 5S for 2.5 years, and it never broke on me. I owned the 7 for about 36 hours, and I dropped it on the ground. I could not explain why, but I went to – well, I know. I mean, I explained why. I went to the Apple store the next day. But I went to the Apple store the next day, and they replaced it for free.
Nice.
Yeah. Just because, I guess, pity. But, hey, I'll take it.
They said put a case on it like your wife told you.
Oh, God almighty.
Here's
woman.
The lesson. Here's
I always lesson, have kids. The case on it. I was waiting for a good one to come out. No. That's it.
You always have
the lesson, kids, is don't take your iPhone 7 into the jungle.
Yes.
That's what we learned.
Yeah. That was what did it. Jungle Cruise, which was a great Jungle Cruise skipper. We had that night. That was a lot of fun. I wish I could remember the name, but I can't.
Wasn't it Timothy? I want to say
Timothy. I was gonna say Timothy. So, okay. Yeah, so.
All right. There you go. Melissa.
Yes.
All right. Do we have reviews?
We have a lot of reviews.
We have a lot of reviews.
Because Canada is weird. Well, actually, not Canada is weird, although I'm sure that statement's accurate in some parts. iTunes is weird.
You're going to make Stan very upset.
Stan, you can email her.
She doesn't speak for everybody.
Yeah.
No, it's okay. They'll just apologize.
You can email her. Okay. I believe Melissa's email is I hate Canada for some reason at AOL.com.
AOL?
I still have an AOL. Got that AOL account. All right, read our reviews, please. All right,
we'll go from the U.S. iTunes first.
Okay.
We had two up there. We have one from BC Bachman, my favorite Disney podcast. This is a great way to start my day at work. The combination of new movie reviews, park info, and reviews of historical movies is fantastic. It is also really easy to listen to all of the older episodes without them feeling out of date. Pete is a wonderful host.
Swell.
And Melissa's complete disregard for the rules always makes for a fun finish to the show.
I like how that's become a thing that everyone makes a comment of. Thank you so much.
Don't miss the show. Thank you. All right. Then we also have Disney Fantastic from Mario Susie. I'm a huge Disney fan, and so are these people. Hence, they make me feel normal.
Good.
Their podcasts are informative, funny, and entertaining. I find myself talking back as if I were there with them. Susie. Thank you, Susie. All right, now let's go to Canada.
Canada, you are our nation's hat.
That's not how it goes. That's not how it goes.
Go for it. Read, woman. Read.
Okay, we're starting back in January because apparently we don't get notified.
Yeah, we don't get notified of
these. Which is so sad because these are really nice.
Yeah.
All right, so from...
Oh, you better read this correctly.
You want to read it?
Sith Outcast 85. Nice. That's a good name. That's a good name.
I would not have said it that way, so very nice.
Yeah, that's a good name.
All right, we have great group. I really enjoyed the group dynamic on this podcast. Great discussion. Great dissection of the films they discuss. Everyone should listen to this show. Thank you. Then we have Mr. Stan Solo, number one.
Stan Solo.
Fifth star to the right. I like that.
That's good.
I'm new to this podcast, but was hooked immediately after just two episodes. All too often, Disney podcasts are poorly produced, have no humor, biased, or are just dull. This one is none of that. The chemistry between the host is perfect, and I feel like... They are a group of friends just talking Disney. That is what we all are.
That is exactly what we are. So, Stan, you nailed it, mate. Thank you very, very much. We all really appreciate all the positive words.
Yeah, definitely.
I have two more.
Oh, my God.
Oh, whoa. Geez,
I told you we had a lot.
Oh, okay.
Because we didn't have any from Canada. And these two were actually sent to me from Laura. She was a really big help with this. So we have Josh Smith K2. Fun, funny, and informative. A great podcast for any Disney lover, from the casual to full-on Disnerd. The movie reviews are a fun roundtable discussion with sometimes varying views and always honest, and not just a bunch of random words. Very nice. Aside from the movie reviews, they also cover park news, events, and tours. Overall, a fantastic podcast. Keep up the great work.
Yay!
Thank you. And then Lalowin. The greatest people and an awesome podcast. I've been listening to DMH since December 2015 when I started planning my epic 30th birthday trip to WDW. Having never been there before and being an avid traveler, I looked for ways to prepare for my trip that I could pursue during my hour-long commute to and from work in the gridlock city of Shanghai. Oh, girl, I feel you with the gridlock. You definitely have it worse than I do, though, I think.
And living in Shanghai.
Yeah.
We all live in Shanghai.
We all live there.
Spoiler.
First, I discovered a certain other famous Disney podcast, and then I tapped into DMH, and it quickly became my favorite. Pete, Melissa, Brian, and Scott, along with Ryan P. Wilson, and occasionally the Big Mongello himself, became my constant companion. Don't make me laugh. Became my constant companions on the dreary bus rides and have made me laugh out loud and cry a bit with their different and highly creative show themes. I'm in the Facebook group, and I honestly feel like I'm a really big, really wonderful family. Most adults harumph at my love of all things Disney, but when I'm listening to DMH, I know that I'll never be alone in my latest obsession. I'm sorry, late in obsession. Thank you, Disney Magic Hour family. And thank you.
My goodness, that was great.
That was impressive.
Huzzah. Huzzah to that. Three huzzahs. Give that man a rumpf.
Rumpf.
Watch your ass.
My goodness.
All right, folks. That is our show. Right?
Yes.
God. That was a long one, huh?
I hope so.
It was longer than the movie.
It was longer than the movie. Had more plot twists, too. All right. Right now, you are... Well, how do we want to do this? I always feel like I want to do this differently, because now, like... Okay, now the music... Now the song's playing, like, right now. Okay. So right now, you are listening to Wishery. You can find this video and more over at youtube.com/Pogo and all of his music at soundcloud.com /pogomix. This episode of Disney Magic Hour was brought to you by MEI Travel. Guys, do me a favor. Why don't you come down and visit us? And in order to do that in the best possible way and have everything taken care of for you and just know you're getting the best deal possible because they search them out as they come out all the time, go to meitravel.com, speak to all the people.
You only have to speak to one person because they give you one person to take care of all your needs.
Yeah, that's a good point.
We had Charla. She's amazing.
Yeah, she is. She was really good.
I loved it. I told my mom about MEI because she's coming down to visit in the spring. And I was like, just go on there. And you know, they'll take care of you. And she's like, oh, it's like a one-stop shop. I'm like, it's exactly what
Exactamundo.
It is. I loved it. It was like a little infomercial on our conversation.
So do us a favor. Click that banner. Go on over. Let them know how you heard about them. And come and visit us. We got a lot of people visiting for Star Wars Celebration, which is going to be kind of fun. I'm looking forward to that a lot.
April.
That is April, yes.
I forgot the exact
dates. Next year. I'll look up the dates and you got
to
make some plans for that, my man.
Yeah.
Who are we, though? We are lastgenpodcast.com. Find us on Twitter at Diz Magic Hour Pod. That's DIS Magic Hour Pod. You can find us on Facebook at the Disney Magic Hour Group. Just search for that and you can find us. Add us to yourself. If you head on over to iTunes, as many, many, many folk did, thank you so much, and leave a 5-star review, we will read it live-ish, because this isn't live, but on the air.
And if you do make a comment on iTunes in the Canada Store, please find us either on Twitter, on Facebook, somewhere. Reach out to us. Let us know. And as soon as your review pops up, send us a screenshot of it so we can read it because we don't have access to this.
Basically
Canada
anywhere
one.
That you're not in the U.S. because we can only see the U.S. reviews.
I think there are some UK reviews that show up on the American one.
Right. Apple makes no sense.
Yeah, Apple doesn't make any sense.
You can find all of our previous episodes over at soundcloud.com/Disney Magic Hour Podcast. And Melissa, Instagram info now.
At Disney Magic Hour Podcast.
It's not as dramatic as I was hoping, but very well.
No, I try to make it very clean.
Ryan Wilson, 9 years. Nine years. Over at the Gazette. Where can everyone find you and all the phenomenal work that you do?
Locked at this desk because it took 9 years to do all of this. The Main Street Gazette, mainstgazette.com, mainstgazette at Twitter, at Instagram, and search Main Street Gazette on Facebook, and you'll find us there.
Till next week, say goodnight, Melissa.
Goodnight, Melissa.
Say goodnight, Brian.
Goodnight, Brian.
Say goodnight, Ryan.
Goodnight, Ryan.
Goodnight, Pete. Go do that voodoo that you do so well.